But would also like to
Can I send you an email? Sure, definitely send me the information. Let's see if I have some cards on here.
It is going to be a nice
And then, we're hoping to kind of
Well, Tara knows all the players. I mean, she actually was working for me at the UN Action Committee. And she was there as well.
Yeah, she's actually written a human rights week.
Oh, she has written.
She's written that will be published in the
Fabulous. Okay, because we had actually been in touch with Reed, and we were thinking of writing something, and we never heard back from them. So it's probably because Tara wrote it first.
Very privileged to have Aaron Lindahl and Professor Wander here rights and the UN Convention on the Rights of Persons with Disabilities. And so I'm going to let Professor Bierstein go first and introduce our guest.
Thank you, Emily. See, all raising the people gratitude for that. Feel free to come up closer. I'm really pleased that we have Eric with us today, both to hear from him and to introduce the video that he's going to show us. It's a video which I use shamelessly in my disability seminar beginning of every year, in part to give some kind of concreteness to the issues that people with disabilities face, both nationally and internationally. Eric is executive director of Mental Disability Rights International, as he said, and one of the really exciting things about Eric's work, and having been involved with MDRI from the beginning, is to see it start from really one person's idea when there was no international human rights for people with disabilities, and even human rights organizations denied existence of this issue at all, to now seeing what is becoming a really vibrant field, most obviously reflected in the recent adoption of the UN Convention. So in 13 and a half short years, we've gone from what do you mean disability and human rights issues, something that was very much on the radar screen. That doesn't mean we've achieved anything really in depth, but we need to go to that next step of actually implementing some of the rights issues and dealing with some of the contradictions, some of the problems. The organization has had a long connection with Washington College of Law, at least for several years. MDRI was located here at the Washington College of Law before we moved into this nice new building. I was at that time the director of the clinic. We had a little one-story World War II-era shack on what is now the grounds of the Lovely Museum. At that time it wasn't quite lovely, and Eric's office was in this connected old gym next to it. So we felt like we were both living in a kind of...
It was a dance alley, and lots of different things.
It also attracted lots of non-human creatures and parasites. From those very modest beginnings and from an initial group of a three-person board, which included Herman Schwartz, which was very important in the creation of the organization, and the director of the Institute of Human Rights, the organization has grown leaps and bounds. How many months staff now? We have nine people now that are very active and with the student board of directors. We've got a student to serve on until this past December when Carbon Sites got away from young blood take over. The critical part of the work that Eric just talked about that I think is to say is, unlike some human rights work where the notion is you go in, analyze the situation, you write a devastating report, and you leave. But from the beginning, MDRI focus has been on sustainability, on building local advocacy, sometimes creating local advocacy or advocacy, or building on the beginnings of it where it had, to help people figure out not just here's a report, that's nice, but to really change situations, change circumstances. It's focused not just on what's wrong with abusive institutions where people are beaten up, die, otherwise mistreated. But what's the positive response to that? How do you not simply build a nice, new, shiny institution that is an institution, but rather develop community-based programs and other services that people are looking for? That's been seemingly an easy thing to say. It's hard sometimes to get even well-intentioned people in the world, funders, UN, other entities, which sometimes don't forget what services need to be there. But I think the work of MDRI, which is I'm very proud to be associated with, has been substantively very solid, very humane, important service, wonderful, very important. And the mix of both individual advocacy, the personal stories that you get from going to some of these institutions, with the overall policy advocacy for the Inter-American Commission, importantly for the UN, made this really an extraordinary organization. And it's really all the American.
Thank you very much for that introduction. I think before I punch in, I think the most important pizza. So why don't everyone grab pizza and do not hesitate. And we'll just start at me. I'm going to grab. grabbing the bottle of water. As Bob said, it's a real pleasure to be back here at American University in the law school. I got my start here when Bob says it was a one-person organization. It was one person plus a law school. I was straight out of law school myself at Georgetown, had an idea, shopped it around, and it was really Professor Herman Schwartz who had independently been thinking about this idea for many years. And he invited me into law school, gave me free office space, and probably broke about a dozen major university rules to kind of establish the organization without bothering to check with the bureaucracy, which is, when you've got to get something done, you've got to get something done. So I owe an enormous amount to Herman. And then Bob has been the longest serving member of the board from the very beginning until last December. Just an absolute pleasure to be here. We very often work with students, and indeed, one of our most senior attorneys now, who runs our project in Latin America, is Allison Hillman, who is a graduate of this law school and did the Human Rights Clinic here at the law school, had done some work in Latin America, and I have a copy of a report that she wrote here on Peru. We're doing one in Argentina. So it's been a real wonderful collaboration law school and NDRI. It is just truly exciting to be talking about the new UN Disability Rights Convention. Again, 13 years of this work, many years wandering in the wilderness, being a human rights activist, talking about the rights of a population, and the mainstream human rights community saying, what are you talking about? If you look at the core documents of the International Human Rights Treaty, there may be broad language on everyone having basic rights, and yet people with disabilities, people with psychiatric disabilities, developmental disabilities, mental health issues, these issues were never explicitly addressed. Even the core protection against discrimination in the Universal Declaration and the Covenant on Civil and Political Rights mentions race, national origin, sex, and then four other status. And for many, many years, it never even dawned on the United Nations to say disability. And it took until the early 1990s before the United Nations explicitly said four other status includes people with disabilities. And the result was that mainstream human rights organizations overlooked this issue, and governments overlooked this issue. When governments are not held accountable, they are left to believe that however they choose to treat people with mental disabilities, that's just fine. That in terms of domestic sovereignty, this is a national mental health policy. It's how we have to structure our social welfare system. And if people happen to be locked up, naked, in horrible conditions, and left to die, as I will tell you, we have seen, that was considered, well, I guess there's not enough money for our mental health policy. We'll have to sit and talk about that. The concept that that's a core human right was simply never brought to government attention. There is much in the UN Disability Convention that is truly inspiring. It takes the concept of discrimination and goes through many aspects of life that people with disabilities live and show. If you want a society that is non-discriminatory, that society must be physically accessible in terms of both the built environment, in terms of services and programs, that in healthcare services that are available to the population as a whole have to be available to people with disabilities. It is built upon the principles of full inclusion in society. So if you have an educational program, that program has to be accessible to people with disabilities. It has to be appropriate for people who have mental disabilities at every level. There's a right to full participation. You can no longer say, well, a person has a disability, therefore they can't vote. They can't participate in society. So the concepts of non-discrimination are translated into very real practical ways that matter in the lives of people with disabilities. Accessibility, full inclusion, the concept of independent living, that a person with a disability needs to not only be part of society, but maybe require some kind of support to be able to live independently and ultimately no longer be a subject of charity, but to make their own basic choices about how they live their lives.
These are principles that in the United States have taken 20, 30 years to develop as the disability rights movement has taken hold, and now they have found their way to being recognized within international human law, for example. In the specialized area that I work, the rights of people with psychiatric or intellectual disabilities, sometimes referred to as developmental or sensory retardation, the question is, how does the convention apply and what will it mean for people? I'll have to say, it was an amazing experience being up in New York at the ad hoc committee at the drafting process. It started out small, but over time there were over 100 countries represented, and people with disabilities from all over the world participated in the drafting process. And just to look out over a sea of people with such a broad array of national backgrounds and disabilities and cultural orientations was quite amazing. And this disability convention reflects much more of a civil society perspective, the perspective of the stakeholders, than any other drafting process has ever allowed for any other convention. That had a very interesting impact when it came to the mental health issues. The areas where consensus was most easy was on those issues of accessibility and full inclusion. It was heavily weighted towards the population of people with physical disabilities. Yet there was a strong presence for the first time of people with psychiatric disabilities and people with intellectual disabilities. And from the perspective of many of the organized movement of people with psychiatric disabilities, what are some of the key issues that they're concerned about? They're concerned about not just full participation in society, but being recognized to be able to make basic choices about their lives. The way rights have been stripped away for people with mental disabilities has been to say, well, you're incompetent, therefore you can't make choices, therefore we will perhaps put you under guardianship, which is there in theory for your own protection, but all too often, guardianship becomes an excuse for stripping away your choices and stripping away your ability to make decisions. The positions of the organizations of people with intellectual disabilities, psychiatric disabilities, were, let's do away with the whole idea of guardianship. Let's recognize that people under international human rights law always have the ability to make choices about themselves. Now that's a somewhat radical position, and indeed, there is no country in the world that fully recognizes it. So they started out saying, we want to be recognized as being able to make choices for ourselves in all circumstances. You've got these conventions, you've got these countries coming around the world to adopt a convention, and I was thinking, oh my God, you know, when is this whole system going to fall apart? Because when, you know, they're talking about the importance of the stakeholders being part of the decision-making process, and the stakeholders are taking a position that's fairly radical here, that the governments are never going to go along with. Similarly, with psychiatric disabilities, not only do they oppose poor conditions in institutions, they oppose institutionalization itself. They wanted to ban coercive treatment. They wanted to ban any institutionalization. My organization, which has up to now had the position of trying to say, what does international human rights law protect, and what can we do? How can we push the limits of existing international human rights law? Never before had to deal with these fundamental questions of what would we want under the best of possible circumstances, because the reality of the world is so far apart from that. When I started this, while I was in law school, I sat and I wrote a law review article, and I looked, well, if there is no convention on the rights of people with mental disabilities, what are the core protections out there? And in the beginning, it was an amazing thing to see, because if you do a literature survey on mental health and human rights, there was a total blank. When political dissidents in the former Soviet Union were put in psychiatric hospitals, there was a literature on that, but they were being locked up because they were political dissidents. There was nothing on when could you or could you not lock up a person with mental disabilities. And so we looked at, well, what are the protections? There are protections against arbitrary detention. And when is detention arbitrary and when was it not? And then the United Nations General Assembly adopted a non-binding resolution called the Principles for the Protection of Persons with Mental Illness. And it said if a person is going to be locked up, they have a right to a hearing, they have a right to a lawyer. You can't lock up a person unless they're found to be mentally ill and dangerous to themselves or others. If a person's legal right to make decisions are going to be taken away, you can only do that that based upon a hearing. So there was this non-binding General Assembly resolution that provided all these procedural protections. And that's what I built my work on when I first started this organization. When it came down to the drafting process, many of the advocacy organizations were actually opposed to building in these procedural protections because they were looking for substantive protections. They were looking for banning a lot of these practices. And if you actually look at the procedural protections, in many ways, the procedural protections under the General Assembly resolution were not as strong as exist in some countries. So if you build into a convention a wishy-washy procedural protection, you've sold out that underlying right. And if you want your core right document to be an aspirational goal to work for a society with more support in the community so that people don't have to be locked up, they took a very principled position that there should be nothing in that convention that is less than what we aspire to. So the language in the convention ended up being some very carefully worded compromises. And I have to say, it was the mandate, the UN mandate for the drafting process ended I can't remember the date, late in August of last summer. And we were literally down to the last few minutes. The clock was ticking. The translators had been paid till 6 p.m. And after that, they had to work as volunteers. One wasn't paying for them. 6 p.m. came and went, and there hadn't been a compromise. And at the very end, there was some compromise language adopted, literally after the translators were already supposed to have gone home. This UN convention that we're going to be living with for years to come is the product of some very careful compromises that only happened at the last minute. Let me just direct your attention to a couple of the key provisions. The Article 12, having to do with this issue of competency, equal recognition before the law, states parties reaffirm that people with disabilities have the right to recognition everywhere as a person, and that people with disabilities enjoy legal capacity on an equal basis with others in all aspects of life. That's a pretty broad statement that allows for no exceptions, except each party shall take appropriate measures to provide access by persons with disabilities to the support they may require in exercising their legal capacity. States may adopt safeguards. It is built in a manner that essentially recognizes people have a right to make choices no matter what, and that they're allowed the support necessary to make those choices. Now the question is, what is the support necessary? And one argument that guardianship is in fact the support that's necessary. Going on to the issue of locking up a person in an institution, liberty and security of a person, the procedural protections were not built in, but we get a very broad statement. State parties shall ensure that people with disabilities, on an equal basis with others, enjoy the right to liberty and security of a person, and that they are not deprived of their liberty unlawfully or arbitrarily, but it doesn't say what unlawfully or arbitrarily is. So the battle lines are out there. Interpreting the convention is going to be a challenge. There are these very broad principles, and in the end, I would argue that it's the core principles, not the specific principles on mental disability, that are going to matter. The principles of full inclusion in society, of participation, of non-discrimination, that's what's going to change. And what's ultimately going to be the most important is the very concept that people with disabilities have basic human rights. And that concept is what I have been struggling for 13 years. So I want to step back. I'm going to show you a little video that is now a little outdated because it describes our work, gives you a flavor of some of the human rights abuses we're challenging. But you'll notice in there, no reference to the convention, there's a reference to the principles for the protection of persons with mental illness and the non-binding resolutions that we're dealing with. Give you some of the flavor of, in practice, what are the abuses that we're facing, what are the challenges that we overcome, and then afterwards we can put the pieces together and see what this convention will offer us. So this is hard to see unless we turn off the lights. So if there's someone in the back, that volume down there, if there's some of this, I'll warn you, it can be a little
hard to see. There's some really terrible things to be witnessed.
Every room is communal. Clothes are shared, the bathrooms are filthy, puddles of urine dot the floor, and the conditions are utterly dehumanized.
There are 5 cups for 99 patients.
Including some of the women who urinated over here.
Most of these women patients are severely understaffed and overflowing with demand. Medical attention is often inappropriate or hopelessly inadequate. A shockingly common problem is self-abuse. Children and adults starve for stimulation and equip themselves to feel something, anything. So staff respond by tying them down for hours on end. In one institution in Mexico, MDRI investigators came across a child strapped down in a wheelchair with sheets wrapped around his body.
No, they're tying it under, they're putting the restraints under the mattress there, so we can't
take the restraints off.
Right.
Staff did not have time to tend to people or to give them the care they need.
This man has been running up and down this hall for the last half an hour, maybe.
At stake is not just the patient's immediate well-being, but their long-term condition. For young children, starving with attention will have lifelong consequences.
Look at the littlest contact with the sun. You just have so much energy walking around.
Activists like Eric Rosenthal see community integration as the answer to many of these problems. For legal precedent, he turns to the 1991 UN Principles for the Protection of Persons with Mental Illness, which state that every person with mental illness shall have the right to live and work to the extent possible in the community. Authorities admit that people are detained in institutions because they have nowhere else to go. Once they are admitted, it is often hard for patients to leave, whether they are fit to or not. The legal mechanisms to protect against arbitrary detention do not exist, or there may be nowhere and no one to release them to. According to the director of one Mexican institution, 80% of the people detained did not need to be there. Faced with tremendous stigma and discrimination and no supportive care in the community, the burden of caring for people with mental disabilities is often left to the family. When they cannot cope or they feel they have no choice but to place a relative in an institution, they are often blamed by mental problems. In Mexico, people placed in institutions by family members are called abandonados. In this case, there were 15 abandonados.
Of the 15, 12 have been in traditional structural coordinators, and the rest
And is it difficult to find their families?
If the families have never permanently admitted the real address when they bring them for admission, and then the emotional bonds weaken over time, the close family members, like parents and children, suffer severely, and only more distant relatives remain, but definitely they want to take responsibility for the patient.
In countries of the former Soviet Union, family members have reported to MDRI that doctors told them to give up a disabled child immediately after birth so they will not become under attached to the baby. Many families are heartbroken by the pressure to give up their child and will do anything to keep them at home.
These are children that are waiting for patients. The family takes them to different psychiatrists, specialists to see if there's any more they can do anything with them within their home. And then the RO recommend us to say that we take them to different institutions. And the second level is that socially they're not able to have a specialist come to their homes and take care of them. That's why they agree to the children who are
in addition to documenting abuses, NDRI works closely with activists who are working to challenge discrimination and reform laws in their home country. Davor Bambo is a Hungarian citizen who founded the Voice of Soul, an advocacy organization made up of psychiatric survivors.
Then we feel that we are not alone. We can share knowledge, expertise, about techniques, how we can influence legislation, how we can improve human rights conditions.
NDRI is fighting for the day when mental disability rights are an accepted part of the international human rights agenda. One significant step in the right direction was taken in March 2000 when NDRI presented the findings of its report on abuses in mental health psychiatric facilities to the Inter-American Commission on Human Rights. As a consequence, for the first time ever, the next annual report of the Commission on Mexico's Human Rights Record raises concerns about conditions in psychiatric facilities there. Shortly after these public hearings, Mexico declared that it would close one of the most abusive institutions. For mental disability activists, it's another step on the road to widespread recognition of some long-ignored basic human rights. For further information on what you can do to help the cause of people in institutions around the world, contact NDRI.
What happens to the people that, if the people with the mental disabilities aren't in institutions, where are they?
Where are they? Very good question. For many years, it was thought that a person with a mental disability can't take care of themselves, has to be locked up. And if you go back to the 1950s in the United States, we had 500,000 people in psychiatric hospitals. And if you extrapolate upwards towards today's population, you have more than 2 million in fact, we have something in the order of 50,000 people in long-term institutionalization in the United States. So something called deinstitutionalization. And then the question is, what happened to them? The best of what happened is that community supports were created, homes in the community. If a parent can't be expected, throughout life to take care of a person with mental disability, the idea that a person retardation or mental illness could live on their own with some form of support that comes to their home, in a group home, in their own apartment, that they could get assistance to go to work, that they could have programs to make sure that they get adequate medical care, social workers to visit them every day in their home. Social service systems have transformed in the United States since that time when it was assumed that it's happened in some places very successfully, and it's happened in some places not so successfully. The transformation with regard to people who have developmental disabilities has actually been much more successful in many areas where it's been shown to completely close down institutions. And once people are moved to the community, supported in the community, they can stay there forever. With regard to psychiatric facilities, it's a little harder because some of the course and the experience of mental illness may be that it's episodic, and a person can still have a crisis where they can be dangerous to themselves or others. So when the systems have worked, community supports have been created for people who had a diagnosis of mental illness, and many of those people are able to recover fully, return to society, and you never know that they once had an episode. And, probably a certain percentage of the U.S. Congress and various other leading artists
you know, all went through that moment and are now part of society and you don't even realize it. There are, it is understood under U.S. law that when you are going through a crisis and if you are dangerous to yourselves or others, that there are procedures for locking people up, and the idea is to have them in short-term acute care until they're stabilized and then returned to the community. The other part of it is that in the United States in particular, where we have not funded our community services adequately, you've often had the closure of institutions, failure to provide community services, and then people left out on the streets. In the early 1980s, when the deinstitutionalization movement started and coincided with the Reagan period of slashing social services, you had a terrible, terrible homelessness problem, and a lot was blamed on deinstitutionalization. And many people have many different views on that. My understanding is that it wasn't so much deinstitutionalization that was a failure, but it was a failure to provide adequate funding for the alternatives. Now, that's the U.S. experience. The experience in other countries is a little different. There are countries in Europe that have done a better job than the United States has. In Europe, they tend to be more generous in the provision of social welfare services in the community, and they tend to be less rights-oriented in terms of some of the protections that we provide. So they've got a kind of somewhat more paternalistic, but also more community-oriented program. In much of the developing world that I've worked, it's as if that whole transformation never happened. In Mexico, where some of this was done, in South America, in Argentina, where we're about to do a report, in Eastern Europe, these massive institutions were created, and there was never an advocacy movement, citizens demanding reform in their own country. Never rights are created, and so those people are still languishing away in those long-term facilities, and those are some of the horrible scenes that you observe. So a lot of what my organization has done is gone in, we do investigations, we publicize, we pressure through the international community, but we also then train activists to work on reform.
I would just add another phenomenon, people call trans-institutional work, so that in the United States, a lot of people who formerly were in mental hospitals now are not. They wind up in jails, they wind up in prisons. And there was a fascinating article recently, as you know, the level of prison in the United States is huge compared to prison. But if you kind of take the total number of people institutionalized and people who were in faculty past were fighting in mental hospitals and the number of people who were in prison and jail then, now, that number is actually a relatively stable number. We've sort of shifted a lot of people from one kind of institution to another. It's fair to say that if mental hospitals were not committed to provide quality service in jail or that's a huge issue. As Eric said, it really is more with regards to people with psychiatric disabilities than intellectual disabilities. So, I mean, there's a lot of issues between intersection between criminal justice and
I just have in your mind, in your experience, is it better to deinstitutionalize or improve the institutions that are there to provide better services and better communal integration?
Well, we had that experience in the United States, and when the activists in the early 60s and 70s started working on these issues, there was a lot of controversy among activists about what the best approach was. And what was found was there was early a lot of the litigation in the civil rights area was about conditions in institutions and to improve conditions in institutions. And what the findings of the activists were is that you could pour money in an institution, build a nice new building. The building doesn't stay very nice for very long. And ultimately, if the goal is rehabilitation and reintegration into society, that when a person is in an institution, they essentially become dependent on the institution. They become institutionalized. You know, it's easier to provide everyone with breakfast at 8 o'clock in the morning and everyone gets a donut and a cup of coffee. And, you know, what happens if you don't like donuts? It's regimented. It creates and fosters dependency. And it's really hard to create the skills that you need to live in the community if you happen to be the institution. With regard to children in particular, the evidence is that it's psychologically damaging to children in institutions. Certainly true of adults too, but even more true with children. And so
there are studies now that have shown, particularly with regard to orphanages, that you can have the most beautifully funded, highly staffed orphanage, but if a child does not have the opportunity to create emotional bonds with a parent, a stable parent, or parent-like figure, they will become emotionally disabled. And therefore, the experience is very much just fixing up institutions won't do it. You have to do is build that those community relationships and get people into the community. In our work, when you find these extreme abuses, people are literally freezing to death in an institution, as we found in Mexico, Armenia, Romania. Well, the first thing you may have to do is fix the heat in the institution so they don't die. So it may take 6 months or a year or 2 years or 3 years or 5 years to create community services. So there has to be some balance between the core minimum that you need to protect basic dignity and rights and make sure people live, but the ultimate effort has to be.
The reason for me asking my first question was that there's obviously a money problem in third world countries, and also in the video it showed that they were closing down a center in Mexico and that the activists were happy about that. To me it just seems like closing down a center, however bad the conditions are in it, just sends those people back onto the streets, especially since you can't find their families. And when you can't get more money to actually improve the conditions within the centers, what's the solution? And also, with regard to international law, you can't impose on a country to actually give more money to an institution.
Okay, let me try to answer that on a few different levels. In Mexico in particular, I've got a few copies of the Mexico report, and there's a little appendix here. After we exposed the abuses in the institution in Mexico, the government was terribly ashamed. They actually called us in and said, what can we do about this? We've got these horrible institutions. The psychiatrist, who's the co-author of our report, flew down to Mexico, and his first offer was to help them protect basic rights in this particular institution. There was no running water. People were left in utterly filthy conditions. And they found that the cost of putting pipes into this ancient structure that was out in the desert was going to cost more than creating new homes in the community. So if you're going to do anything and keep these people alive in the circumstances of abusive facility in a remote location in Mexico, it was less expensive to create community alternatives for them than to fix up the institution for two-thirds of the patients. One-third of the patients were indeed trans-institutionalized, those patients who were had some medical needs that at that point Mexico didn't have the ability to provide institutions. So it can be somewhat murky. Some patients, less expensive to provide community services. For some patients, it's more expensive. For two-thirds of the patients, there's an appendix to this book that shows what happened afterwards. Within 6 months of the release of our report, they closed down the most abusive facility we have documented, and two-thirds of those people were integrated into the community. Where there's political will, there's a way. Mexico came up with the money and created facilities for those two-thirds of those people. For one-third, ongoing struggle, it's still not solved right now. They were moved to better, cleaner facilities in the city, but still were institutions when we were last there. So for a practical matter, sometimes it's more money, sometimes it's less money. And political pressure, countries say, well, sorry, we don't have enough money, and it's amazing what can happen when you put a little pressure on. In Turkey, we recently released a report where we found that 15,000 people a year were getting unmodified electroshock treatment, which is in the United States, there's a cure for depression, or at least a temporary cure where they give you a shock to your brain, and it relieves depression for a short period of time. That practice is used in the United States fairly often when people are under full anesthesia. In Turkey and many other countries, they were doing this without anesthesia, just a straight electric shock. It causes an impulsion, it causes a seizure. It's horrendously painful. It turns people into zombies, makes them that's what they were doing in Turkey. In the government of Turkey says, well, it's much too expensive for us to provide anesthesia for these patients, and we have to hire an anesthesiologist. We can't afford it. We released the report. We embarrassed them publicly, and they came up with the money pretty darn quick. And now that practice has been ended.
And by the way, I was in Malawi for WHO, and they say the same thing. ever. That's very important. I was with a psychiatrist from Zimbabwe who pointed out that he didn't necessarily need a fully trained anesthesiologist. He needs somebody who can train in how to provide the anesthesia. And that can be done with much more body training. And much more training. We actually watched the administration of unmodified anesthesia. So it takes a film of one of the comments that was really quite awful. And yet still we're being argued on the part of
As a legal matter, then, the question of what can the law compel and what can the law not compel? As you may know, under international law, there are divisions between what's considered civil and political rights and what's considered economic and social rights. To protect against abuses that are civil and political rights, there's an immediate obligation of outcome. You are not allowed to be in torture. And if the government has to spend money, necessary so that these individuals are not tortured, there is an obligation to spend the money that is necessary. So under the example of people who are left to die because there's not enough heating in institutions, if there's not running water, or if they're being shot, the government cannot shock people without providing anesthesia. They are required to provide that money. Then the question is, are they required under international law to provide the funds necessary for community integration? And that is actually a very good lead to the significance of the convention and how we have argued that the right to community integration means that indeed governments are under that obligation. And I'm going to give an example of that. I'm going to hold off.
We have a couple of minutes left. Actually, I don't think we probably have time for any more questions because there's a class that starts in here in about 6 minutes.
Here,
but
I noticed that you do a lot of work in Eastern Europe, Middle East, and Latin America. I was wondering about how the countries were chosen.
We'd love to do work in Asia. Mostly it's a resource question, just what we've got funding to do and where we can find collaboration. But it's a worldwide problem. We'd love to do work in Asia. Check our website. We've got reports on this. I'm sorry I haven't had a chance to go into it. We did a case in Paraguay where we brought a precautionary measures petition to the Inter-American Commission. And the government of Paraguay, in order to avoid litigation in the system, settled and agreed to restructure its mental health. So we are working demonstrate that there is a legal right to community integration and governments are under an obligation. It may be the obligation under economic and social rights law where there is a progressive realization of those rights. It may not happen overnight. It may take time. It certainly took time in the United States, so it will take time. The idea that countries are obliged to provide for the community integration, the deinstitutionalization is not just do we want to do it, do we not. The new UN Disability Convention have an obligation of international law for any country that ratifies.
Thank you. Thanks so much for making the trip up to WCL.
I've got a few handouts here.
Sorry, I
would
just
look at
them. Quick announcement too, on February 13th, Tuesday, there's a symposium and it's an all-day health law event. You can find more information in the special events section of the website and Founders Day. Thanks for coming,
everybody.
Good job coming.
Email me the other day. I don't know if it was Steve and Matt.
somebody else in that. I was looking for someone, not that one. Before, for Frederick, they're doing an argument class. Until time, someone comes in that was like, very smart. Not Miles.
Damages because you were aware of the danger and didn't take corrective And so, person put between a rock and a hard place. And so the law says, you know, we ought to encourage people to do these kinds of corrective measures. And so we're going to make this privileged in the sense that you can't use it against people as on the question of negligence or any other form of standard of culpability. Now, that doesn't mean under the concept of multiple admissibility, you couldn't otherwise use it if you were offering it for some other purpose. For example, show that they own the property if they deny it. Now, all these other purposes have to be in dispute. If they claimed it was not feasible to change the design of the product, and they already had, you could use it against them. They claimed they'd given up the leasehold, and they went back and repaired the stairs, which was one of the problems. You can use it against them. Just yesterday, I was looking at a case in the recorder system where they contested whether the instrumentality was the cause of the injury. And they allowed remedial measures to come in to prove causation, even because it wasn't being offered on the question of negligence or culpable conduct. So there are a lot of other grounds for which you might be able to use it, even though it's precluded on that one ground of negligence or culpable conduct. And in the courts doing this, they take a very literal interpretation of the federal rule. Now, repair by somebody else doesn't have that problem, doesn't pose the problem, because if you use against me the fact that you made a repair to this product, that will discourage you from making repairs to this product. The problem, though, is one of relevance, first of all. What relevance is your repairs to another product? But it might be similar. It could be the same product. And it also creates a hearsay problem because you're reading a message into those repairs that someone else made that this product was in need of this repair and was dangerous without it. And you're offering that for the purpose of the matter asserted by that conduct. We're going to get to that in the next class here, starting next week. But the theory of this rule doesn't come into play. You get other problems, negligence and hearsay, or relevance and hearsay. But this rule does not come into play with third-party repairs. And that actually would happen if you've ever been to a truck stop. And you go by, you can't find a parking place close to the building, and you go by these trucks, and you see all these chains wrapped around the back of the truck between the tractor and the trailer. And, you know, you're not in the mountains of Sierra Nevadas, and you're wondering, why do they have the chains on this thing? You would think, well, those are just chains for the tires if they get caught up in the mountains when it's snowing. And actually, it's not. They put those chains somewhere else in the truck. The truckers have actually put the chains around the tractor and then the trailer that they're pulling to compensate for the possibility that this locking mechanism, that's just like a train that connects, if they go into a hard break, sometimes when it comes in fishtails, that will break. The coupling will open up and then the trailer just is spinning freely out there, wiping out everything and everybody that comes in contact with it. So they wrap these chains to keep it tied to the tractor so that the tractor can wipe out everybody with the trailer, I guess. I don't know. Maybe the tractor being heavier will hold it down and keep it from doing the other kind of damage that otherwise would, and they have perhaps some control over it. Could you use that to show the deficiencies in the coupling mechanism? perhaps. It might be relevant that you get the hearsay problem there of the guys, the truckers who actually did that, and the basis upon which they drew conclusions like that. And you get problems of expertise and how they qualified to know that, things of that nature. The question about whether the rationale for this rule is sound, the fact that the law created this privileged status to the remedial measures, first of all, assumes that everybody knows that's the law. I don't think you knew that before you came in here, that you couldn't bring in remedial measures. Maybe you did. Maybe you talked to the court, but most lay people don't know that. And it also assumes that people in general would run the risk, be willing to risk that their neighbors, also more of them, would get injured, and not do it because even if they knew the rule, they would be willing to take that risk for other people. And I'm not sure that that really reflects human nature in general. Nevertheless, we've got the rule. And of course, now, with every rule, the one thing that litigators love doing is getting around the rule. And one of the ways they've tried getting around this rule, where you repair the steps after I fall down the steps coming to your house, and I'm injured. So, what I do is, well, what I'll try to do, and not succeed now, is that I will call you as a witness in the case against you, which I can do. I'll call you as the defendant to the witness stand. And among other things, I will ask you, do you think your steps were safe? Then, well, of course I do. And then I'll ask, well, isn't it a fact, though, that after I fell down your steps, you actually tore them down and repaired them to replace them? And they're going to object, saying, they object, it's kind of evidence excluded, so maybe you cross the ground. I'm not offering it to prove they were negligent. I'm just offering it as a prior inconsistent statement. Obviously, they've made a statement when they previously repaired the stairs suggesting these stairs were not safe. And now on the witness stand, they're coming and saying, yeah, they're safe. And you see, they're inconsistent, and therefore they're not credible because they're inconsistent their own prior statements. And the court's answer to that pretty quickly was bullshit. To do that, you have to accept the underlying premise that's excluded, the inference that's excluded by this rule. We're not letting you do it. You're basically setting up a straw man. You know what his answer is going to be. And of course, the answer to this was, under the common law, there was a rule we'll talk about in impeachment and cross-examination, that you couldn't do this unless you were surprised and damaged. Well, here you couldn't claim surprise if the guy you're suing for negligence has denied your claims in your complaint and has gone to trial. Obviously, they're going to say, no, I'm not negligent. Yeah, steps were safe. And so you can't put them on knowing they're going to say that for the sole purpose of impeaching them and thereby getting around the exclusion of this evidence in the first place on the question of negligence, because it's coming close to doing the same thing. But you've got to give litigators credit. It's a good try. All right. Rule 407 basically codifies the common law. It's interesting, though, the way it's written, it raises an interesting question. Let's go look at the language. When, after an injury or harm, automatically right at the beginning, wait a minute. Why is this? If we are creating this rule because we want to encourage people to make our society safer, why does it have to be after an injury or harm? Why aren't we making all efforts to make our society safer by changing products to make it less threatening? Why don't we just make all of them privileged, regardless of when it happens?
Because there's no no liability that attaches before the actual injury, or potentially
so,
no liability.
So what?
So it wouldn't.
I mean, I said, okay, I see your point. So what? Let me give you an example. It raises another question here, because the rule, as originally written, said negligence or culpable conduct. And it's a good example of how the advisory committee process does not work well. Then we saw the advent of product liability with strict liability, where neither negligence nor culpable conduct was part of the equation. And so they wanted to bring in remedial measures in product liability cases to show the product was defective. That had to be due to any negligence or anything else. Your product was just defective and you put it on the market. And they started doing that and saying, well, this rule doesn't apply. Because, well, product liability, my God, I mean, we're talking about people who make 5 billion widgets and therefore with the quantities and economies of scale, they're going to make these changes because they have to, and we don't need to apply product liability to those cases. Well, but if you've actually studied the issue in any detail and you understand economics and understand what our industrial base comprises, it's mostly small and mid-sized manufacturers. They don't make 5 billion widgets a year. They make a small number of things that they produce a year. So they're not all General Electric, and they're not all General Motors, which, of course, also proves that the theory is not true, because Ford Motor and the Pinto and refusing to make the changes, General Motors and the Oldsmobiles that burst into flames when it was hit in the back and became an inferno, they didn't make the changes because it was not economically to their advantage to do so. So, and it also left out the fact that you didn't just sue someone in product liability. You sued them in contract, tort, negligence, and products liability. So what do you do when you have all these claims in the same suit? You're going to let the remedial measures keep them out for products liability and for negligence and let it come in for the products liability, and they're going to all hear it at the same time and decide all the basis for your cause of action at the same time? Then what was the point? I mean, it's completely ignored the reality of how litigation moves forward. And so after a California case said, no, it doesn't apply to product liability cases, they quickly realized, you know, actually what we're thinking about here of big manufacturers isn't really true. Our premise is false. And so they quickly reversed themselves, and every other circuit went the other way, saying, no, it wouldn't make sense to keep it out of product liability cases. You need it there, too. But the rule says negligence or culpable conduct. So by the strict language of the rule, it should not apply to product liability cases. And every circuit that addressed this issue said, no, the rule has to be read as applying for product liability cases too. Not in the rule. Inconsistent with the limitation in the rule. And the advisory committee would not change the rule until all the circuits agreed. And finally, they were all ignoring the language of the rule, and finally, you know, 20 years later, they get around to changing the rule to be consistent with what the common law was developing out there around this rule that was being ignored. Very good. It's a very good example of how the process does not work properly. So, let's go back to our example. Why does there have to be an injury or harm before this rule takes effect? You are a manufacturer. Your family in manufacturing? No? Well, it might be hard to put yourself in that position. You own a large company. You're wealthy. That'd be nice. Wasn't it great, the old couple getting $248 million? That is great. And their unemployed children are going to get it. So, you make a product that you think
God, there might be a problem with this. Because if they use this for longer than 15 minutes, which is unlikely, but if they use it longer than 15 minutes, this element is going to get hot, and it's actually going to start burning, and this could actually blow up in their faces. And this could cause a lot of problems. Not likely to happen, but we probably ought to recall those things. And let's change the design. Let's first change the design of what we're going to make now. Let's just start making it with a nickel alloy rather than this other thing. It's going to be a little more costly, but it's probably worth it in the long run for our goodwill and potential losses. Now, by your logic, if you make a change, you've already sold all of it, and she uses your product for more than 15 minutes and it blows up in her face, and then she sues you, and you've made your changes before she was injured, she can use your changes against you. But if you wait until her face is blown off, and then you make your changes, she can't use your changes against you. That makes sense to you?
But none of this really makes sense to me, but I think it doesn't serve the underlying policy.
Why does none of it make sense to you?
Because the book's really thick. But it doesn't serve the underlying policy.
Don't be afraid of things because of their size.
The underlying policy of the rule is that if you, because before there's any injury, there's no fear of not making the decision.
Oh, there's no fear? And what if the in-house counsel said, well, you know, ma'am, if you make this thing and people actually are injured, they're going to use it against you. And you say, whoa, well, maybe we shouldn't do it. Why do you have in-house counsel if they're not going to advise you of this?
Well, they would probably advise you to make a change before people get hurt. Or your morality might kick in.
Oh, well, no. Corporations don't have morality. No conscience. It's all economic. That's why the 79-cent part with Ford Pinto wasn't put in. They calculated, well, look who buys Ford Pintos. This is Ford talking. I mean, these are people kind of at the bottom of the economic ladder. I mean, their lives aren't worth a whole hell of a lot. So, you know, so we'll burn them up, and if they get burned up and, you know, don't get out of the car and they're dying, we can fight these things, and by the time we fight it with inflation level of 12% or whatever it is, by the time we fight this through trial, pre-trial, we can put this off for probably 10 years. With inflation, it's probably to our advantage to not make that change. That's the kind of calculation that they made in memos, in-house memos. GE did it too with the Oldsmobile. So it does happen. They do make those calculations, all economic. So by you saying I have to wait until, and isn't that kind of perverse? That it's a rule designed to encourage safety, but I have to wait till somebody's face is blown off with the product before I can make the repairs without having the repairs used against me. I mean, that is really perverse. So why is it limited to after an injury or harm? And that the repairs would make it less likely. If in fact I make any change that would make any kind of injury that happens at any time less likely, why shouldn't I be encouraged to do that? Why shouldn't I be relieved? I mean, I'm not a big corporate advocate, but I mean, don't you have to be fair here? What's the problem with it? You say, well, what if they do it the normal course of business? Well, and what if it doesn't relate to making the injury less likely? Well, that's not relevant then. The litigation. And if it's done the normal course of business, not a design change to make it safer, although it would have made it safer, but it's something they were going to do anyway, well, you can say, well, that's not done for the purpose of a remedial purpose. Maybe you'd have to make a difficult factual determination. Or just say, no, as long as it's an improvement in the product that makes it less dangerous, and makes any injury caused by it less likely, we're not going to let you use that against any of these companies that do it. Where's the beef? I don't know either. I don't know either. We do everything to benefit corporations, advisory committee. I don't understand this. It's like this is tradition and this is the way it is. So, an injury or harm allegedly caused by the event, measures are taken that if taken previously would have made the injury or harm less likely to occur. Evidence, that makes it relevant. Evidence subsequent measures is not admissible to prove negligence, etc., or carpool conduct. And then they've added a defect in the product, a defect in product design, or a need for a warning or instruction. This was a big debate for decades while the advisory committee sat on its hands. And so this is the rule that proves the fact that these rules are basically common law driven, common law revised, and then the advisory committee catches up after the fact and codifies it. Codifies what the courts have already decided probably would be a good approach, which defeats the whole purpose of codification, that they could address and attend to problems even before they cause any issues in the court, in the courtrooms. We still do that, yeah.
Another question. With the post-injury, pre-injury repairs, anyone sort of notice the end of that? Like, once somebody's been injured, not only do you have, you know, the lawsuit, but also, you know, the people have effectually been put on notice and how they interpret that notice.
Well, yeah, you have notice, and so they need to make the, so you have this rock and a hard place justification after an injury, but before an injury, don't you have the safety rationale? I admit you don't have the rock and a hard place thing, but you may later. It may later develop. I still get it. I mean, you know, they bend over backwards to assist corporations, and I'm not saying that's bad. You know, we do need to preserve our industrial base. I just don't know why this has not been part of the debate. Nobody wants to talk about this.
Rules not require exclusive evidence of subpoena measure law for another purpose. And we know that.
And that was common law. Granada Steel is a case actually before the rule, but it's actually the same as it would be under the rule. The result came out exactly the same. It was a repair to a different valve design, which creates relevance problems. I mean, they get patents on these valves, and other people have different valves, and they change their valve design, something on their valve design. Why does that mean that necessarily applies to somebody else's valve design that they manufacture? Now, they all may manufacture the same valve. That's possible. They use variations of the same valve design and do different things with it. That is possible. So you had, and this was a problem made before the injury happened. And well, then apply made before the injury happened. Now, it also happened to be done by a third party, which creates another problem of relevance, but that also makes the rule not apply. Interesting, this other issue, next issue is one that I just read a case on. What if I decide to make the repairs before the injury, but I don't make the repairs until after the injury? Is my decision to make the repairs admissible against me? If there's an injury and I do a study, see if I should make a change in my product. But I don't! Can the study be used against me? So the rule says, make a change in the product. And
a Fifth Circuit, actually a First Circuit case, Princess Carlisle versus Koering, K-O-E-H-R-I-N-G. Let me give you the site. 972 Fed Second 6. Can't do that. That wasn't the recent case. We're Fed Third already. But anyway, these are cases saying, well, no, it has to be. It has to be the actual remedial measure. I used to work in corporations. No corporation acts without studying it first. It's not like somebody pops in, wow, hey, great idea, let's do that and spend billions of dollars. I mean, only in the federal government and the White House do they do that. But that's usually in the billions. How could you not protect the studies? Since they never do things without studying it first, I don't understand the logic of any of this. I am not a defender of corporations. Again, but I don't understand the logic. It seems to me that everything necessarily tied to people making remedial measures, taking remedial measures, that make future injuries less likely, which is what we're shooting for, should all be made privileged. I don't get it. It's like, well, it's just something else we can talk about in the evidence course. Another good issue. I don't want good issues. We've got plenty of issues. This is just silly. And it just makes the course more complicated when you have rationale and then yet they only carry you halfway. They don't keep going with it. But I don't see the downside to carrying that a little further. And again, these are tests that are run in the normal course of business. Well, fine. But if they're tests run because we're concerned about something, and even if they were run in the normal course of business, I'm still not sure. You know, you need a case on your own. If you're relying on the other side to make your case for you by what they do in response, you have a piss-poor case, quite frankly. And so why should we be preserving this when there is a larger social policy end that we can achieve by making it more, by expanding the breadth of the protection? You have a point.
Well, I wanted to, I mean, could it go to not, like, notice or knowledge? Like, that the company had notice or knowledge?
Yes, it could. You establish notice or knowledge, the fact that if they denied it, I didn't know this was happening, and they immediately went and made a repair, which would be inconsistent with that. Feasibility, I don't understand how stuff like this happens. Railroad was sued for someone whose car was hit at the railroad crossing. And the car got stuck between the tracks, and his tires got stuck, and couldn't move, and the train wiped the car out. And their defense was, the crossing could not be constructed. It was not feasible to construct it in any other way, and they had already built another crossing somewhere else that was different and more and safer. It's like, how does that happen? It's like, do you people not talk to one another? You don't. The lawyers brought it in. They said you were contesting feasibility. You've already changed the design of that railroad crossing. Like, I don't know how that happened. And feasibility is an issue of not only possibility, but economic feasibility too. But again, it has to be contested. These issues are like causation. This is the Fifth Circuit case. They came in to prove causation. Verrazas River Authority versus GE Ionics. 2006 Westlaw 318 2188. Fifth Circuit, they said, yeah, I think I'm in proof of causation. So, as the rule is explicitly written, it doesn't preclude it. Now, one of the issues that remedial measures gives rise to, it's the same thing as it would be with insurance. Getting, you can't bring the issues of insurance. They took out liability insurance, probably thinking about doing something reckless. That's why they took out the insurance. Well, that was the old theory of liability insurance. Most people didn't have it at a time when I was a kid. Well, now everybody's got to have it. I mean, it's just you have to have it. The so the question is, with remedial measures, they come in to prove ownership, control, feasibility, causation. Do you ask for the limiting instruction, like, do you ask for the limiting instruction at the insurance company, that you are not to use this as evidence that they were thinking about doing something dangerous, and that's why they got the insurance? Because most people would think, I've never thought of that. That's interesting. And then now they'll think about it. So the limiting instruction in Rule 105 could very well put an idea in their minds they might not otherwise naturally have. And it might not become part of the deliberations. Insurance is probably one that is so old that the idea of not having liability insurance is so well established that you can't do without it, particularly now with corporations. I mean, you'd be sued by the shareholders for negligent mismanagement of corporate assets if you didn't have liability insurance. You just don't do that. They wouldn't think about it. But with remedial measures, maybe they would. So it's a judgment call. You've got to decide. Tactical decision. You ask for the limiting instruction. We've done the first problem. The second problem. Does this come in? It puts siding on the slopes. Apparently this is a big problem in Europe. They don't have the kind of siding you do. And you see, sometimes you go down slopes you really wish weren't on. But we have extensive siding. And they put up more siding here after the lawsuit was initiated. Does it come in? Yeah.
No.
Why?
Well, because presence of an exception here. When the defense says that it was unnecessary, if they said it was unfeasible, then you could bring it up and say, clearly it's feasible because you did it. If they said it was unnecessary, it falls within some of the examples that you read earlier.
So you think it's a pretty easy question? You weren't a little suspicious that was such an easy answer? Yeah? Because they claim the plaintiff was contributory negligent, and this is inconsistent with the claim of contributory negligence, that they should have known. And yet they're putting signage up now. Yeah, the court said, yeah, they raised this new issue, and this goes to prove lack of contributory negligence. It's an admission on their part that it may not have been so obvious. They raised it. And so you have the right to bring it in because contributory negligence has been claimed. Without it, it wouldn't have come in. Offers of compromise. I can offer take less or offer pay less on a claim that I want to get rid of. Does that mean that the claim is not valid because I offer to take or pay less? Or the claim is valid? Or my defense is not valid? Some courts said they thought it was not relevant. I mean, well, why else would you settle? That's like saying, well, I pled guilty, not because I was guilty, but just because it was convenient. Sure. I pled guilty to a criminal charge because it was convenient. Yeah. Therefore, had no evidence. Of course, federal courts anyway said, bullshit. You don't plead guilty to criminal charges because it's convenient. Generally, you plead guilty because you're guilty. If you want to explain that, if you think the jury is stupid enough to accept your explanation, have at it. But it's coming in. Well, offer compromise, you know, generally it does suggest that there's a claim. And your claim is legitimate if I'm offering to pay less or offer to pay less. But the problem is, regardless of that, we would like people like remedial measures. We would like people to settle their claims if they're in dispute. Now, if it's not in dispute, you've got somebody making a claim against you and you don't contest the claim as to validity or amount, you're supposed to take it completely. So you can't, on your telephone bill, pay half of it and say payment in full. Ha ha ha, you accepted my check. You accepted the check. That doesn't work. I tried it, not as long. Not working. It has to be disputed at that point. And then if they cash the check, you say, okay, then they've taken that in settlement of a disputed claim or amount. Now, under the comments, so we want people to try to settle their disputed claims. And so we're going to say, okay, do what you can, talk as much as you can. And that actually applies on very broad scales internationally, too. You try to talk to people about your disputes. And sometimes you can resolve your disputes when you talk to them. Countries that start with IRA. Sometimes that works. If we just talk to them, maybe things can get resolved. Now, the problem, and so we're going to make that protected. Here's the problem. The common law has this quirky little kink in this privilege status they gave to the compromise negotiation. They said, okay, what's privileged is your offer, not what you said around it. Okay, so my client hits your client, so your client will pay for the board. She was ugly in the first place. Didn't hurt her that much. And come on, she's already recovered. You know, they'll say, that's admissible. We'll give you $100 for her face damage. Well, $100 for her face damage is privileged, but okay, assuming she did that. Well, he did hit her in the face of the board. All that's admissible. And so it was a trap for the unwary. And so what you had to do is you had to assume for the sake of argument that I hit you in the face. It's like, God, how strange. It just pissed people off. I mean, assuming. I got a broken nose. Assuming for the sake of argument. And so that's how you had to cast it. It's just silly. It's silly. So they said, well, that's silly. So we're going to make all the discussions around the settlement offers, we're going to make those privileges too. Now, multiple claims, multiple parties presented a unique problem. Can I use your settlement if I were involved in a train act? And you settle with them and they pay you, and I'm still in litigation with them, I'll use your settlement against them as an admission that they are responsible, that they were negligent, and that's why they paid you. But of course, the downside of that is, well, then none of these suits will ever get settled. So we have a mass tort case, and they settle with a few, It means they're going to lose all the rest of them because all that's going to be used against them in their continuing litigation with the others who continue to attest to pursue. So they said, nah, you can't use these. You can't use these against the settlements. We're going to make all of them inadmissible because the whole purpose, and I, you know, this was smart. The theory was you want to encourage compromise. Can't be just on a one-on-one basis. A passport case, you need to be able to give them the opportunity to do it one-on-one, and not having the first one used against them with all the next ones they're going to try to settle. Which, by the way, is how they resolve, how the big lawsuits get resolved. The big drug companies sue all the smaller drug companies for violating their patent. And the big companies, too, are violating their patents. And the big companies have their big guns, and the big famous lawyers and law firms come in, and they do all the work, and their armies are marching in front of the other lawyers who are in back of them, and with their smaller clients, and they're marching, and just saying, okay, go, get it. And so the big company settles with the big company, and they make it absolutely confidential, which means they give them a real bargain. Because we want you out of the lawsuit. This is after you get halfway through the pre-trial process. So they enter into a compromise. This will give you a license, reduce the fee you have, and we'll drop the suit. And absolutely confidential. If you violate this, we have established punitive damages that you have to pay. So nobody talks. It's an issue that's been talked about in the public. Is that proper for the system to have that kind of private litigation settlement? And so then the big armies and the big law firms marching up front disappear. It's like now the Iraqi army's got to do it. And it doesn't have the American army behind them now. They're out there by themselves, kind of naked. And so now they've got to do all the rest of the discovery. They've got to get all this ready for trial. They weren't paying that close attention to it. They're just collecting their fees for going to all the meetings. And now they've got to get it all prepared, and they're not ready for trial. So see, it puts them over a barrel, and then one by one they start falling off. And you get much better settlement deals with them, but they can't talk to the lawyers on the other side. Well, they can, but the lawyers who first settled cannot speak to them, cannot give them the terms in any way. That's how it works. Okay. The Escher versus Brophy case, I'm not going to brief all these things in the future on this. For some reason, I'm not going to. Escher versus Brophy, it's a Minnesota case, common law. I don't think it reflects what would happen today. Because there are very different attitudes about prejudice, bias, and collusion. You know, it's sort of like sexual harassment and child abuse and sexual abuse of women, children. In the past, we didn't want to believe that. We didn't want to accept that. And now we know there's racial biases, there's sexual biases. It's biases that are everywhere. It's kind of the foundation of everything. Everything's built on different kinds of biases. And good and bad ones. In this case, three parties, claim defendant. Defendant settles with Hanley, and then Hanley pays Hanley. Yeah, and then Hanley comes in and says, it's all Zalesley's fault. Testifies, totally inconsistent with the previous settlement that they had engaged in. Testify completely inconsistently saying, no, it was your fault. Yeah, we've settled. We've paid one another. And what that does, it obviously shows the bias. Because they're settled now on reasonable terms for them. And it also opens up possibilities for incredible collusion. Okay, look, I'll pay you, you come in, you testify for me, and I'll give back to you my settlement. If I win that lawsuit, I'll give you what you pay me back. Ultimately, they're going to bear the brunt of it. And them for all responsibility. And that's why Hamley might have a bias, might have motivation to come in and testify inconsistently. It is an inconsistent statement, isn't it? Why should you be allowed to do something as a third party that suggests one thing, when you look at it objectively, come into court and testify completely inconsistently with what you did in that transaction, and expect that not to be used against you, not to be raised, not to be explored, and not let the jury consider the possibility that maybe that's not completely the truth? Yeah. That's right, Hamley paid him. But it's totally inconsistent to say now, isn't it? Facially, it appears to be inconsistent. You can say, well, but there are reasons. Really? Well, tell me. What are they? Now, could you explain that to me, and that might be believable to me? Why shouldn't the jury hear that? Why should we protect this, protect the jury from hearing it? If it's something that happens all the time, using your words, well, why wouldn't the jury know that, probably have heard about that, and probably understand that if it comes up, if it's brought out, and they can give their explanation? Yeah.
Well, aren't these agreements, like, legal on another ground? There's maybe something other agreements I remember hearing about in civil procedure where one plaintiff or one defendant makes an agreement with the plaintiff in regards to the secondary defendant. Aren't those not allowed by the court in the first place? Those sort of collusionary agreements, like in this case?
I don't think so. I'm not aware of it. Let me know.
Okay.
If it is. It certainly wasn't under the common law, and I think this shows a bias. It opens up possibilities of collusion. I just think the court should be more receptive to that argument now than they were before. Not that the rules change. The rule isn't worded any differently. I just think attitudes have changed. Yeah.
Back up just a little bit. Further on in the text, how you explain possibility of bias is clear to me. In this case, bias and collusion isn't clear to me. Hamley pays the defendant, settles the defendant for $50 on a $73 claim, and then turns around and points to the defendant as being 100% responsible for the accident. I don't see where there's an opportunity for collusion. I would understand where...
Hamley gets his $50 back?
But how would he be benefiting the defendant by saying that it was the defendant's fault?
He's saying it's the other guy's fault.
He wasn't. He was saying that...
He testified inconsistent with his settlement.
Right, but he was claiming that it was the defendant's fault in the case.
Okay, but that's inconsistent with saying it's the defendant's fault, isn't it? I pay the defendant and say it's all his fault. So that if I'm the plaintiff and there's collusion with the plaintiff, who called him? Plaintiff. Party check up. Whoever called him could be in collusion with him. But look, if you help me out here, I'll get your money back for you in the judgment. Whichever way it's paid doesn't make any difference.
The plaintiff pays them the $50.
Huh?
The plaintiff then goes and pays them.
Yeah, it would be the one who's using Hamley is having him to testify inconsistent with his prior settlement payment.
What's that? Does that say the plaintiff?
Huh?
Isn't the plaintiff trying to...
It's the defendant's fault.
Right. But so why would Hamley paying the defendant help the plaintiff? It hurts the plaintiff. In his case against the one defendant.
Yes, but he's coming in and saying, that's the whole point. He's coming in and saying it's all the defendant's fault.
Can't wait.
Okay. And he previously paid the defendant.
So the plaintiff didn't get Hambly to pay the defendant.
Well, I don't know whether he did or not. Let's assume he didn't. He said, look, if you'll come in and testify that it's all the defendant's fault, and I win a judgment against the defendant, I'll give you $250 back to you. Would you do it? Assuming you were that kind of person. Hey, it'd be an easy $50. Now, if that's true, shouldn't the defendant be able to say, what are you talking about? You paid me! How do you figure it's my fault? Doesn't he have the right to bring that out? Doesn't this open the possibility of, he's biased against the defendant because he paid him. And he probably doesn't like him. And the collusion with the plaintiff, he might get his money back. So there are two reasons why this could go to impeaching Hamlin. Sorry, I got this part of you switched around. Got Hamlin's name right, though. I got one thing right. All right. I just think attitudes about bias are very different today than they were. We recognize a lot of bias today. And I think it all started unraveling with Martin Luther King bringing out issues of racial bias and then the women's movement bringing out gender bias. It's everywhere. It's just everywhere. So, we're going to make the statements protected with the rule was supposed to be changed in the book, it wasn't. 408. Granting or offering a promise to furnish, attempting or offering a promise to accept, accepting or offering a promise to accept, a valuable consideration in compromise or attempt to compromise a claim, which was disputed as to either validity or amount. This is all common law. It's not admissible to prove liability for invalidity of the claim or its amount. Common law. Evidence and conduct of statements made in compromise negotiations likewise not admissible. That's the evolved common law. This rule does not require the proof of any evidence otherwise discoverable merely because it is, oh, this is a good one. What would happen is I have, this actually happened. I love litigators. They're just, they're really ingenious. They try all kinds of tricks. They're very practical. So they're pretty easy. I mean, they can be difficult, but when they're willing to work with you, they're willing to go a long way and try new things, as long as it opens to possibilities of unfairness happening down the line that's not anticipated, you can't see yet. They know everybody's receptive to that possibility. They're willing to do a lot of things, but they try some shady things too. So, I have a smoking gun that shows we were price fixing with our chief competitor. And we're being sued by a third party under the Sherman Act. Antitrust violation. Asking for a lot of money. So I say, okay, let's meet at a nice restaurant. Have some lunch. Let's talk about settlement this lawsuit. That's fine. And so we go in and we're talk about the Great Australian Open. I hope you guys watch a little of that. Boy, Federer's just unreal. That guy's the greatest player ever. Serena wasn't bad either. Anyway, so we talk about, and so I actually do plea bargaining too with prosecutors. You do criminal stuff. You go in early Monday morning and they're there early and you see them. You talk about the football game and their favorite Patriots. And then they ask you, why are you here? I've got a couple of cases here. I look at your file, which they never let you do otherwise. Just, oh, sure, they're busy getting ready. Just let me see the file. So you go through their file and look at it. Okay, here's the problem. And you talk about it, and you work out a deal. That's the way you do it. So we meet at a restaurant, and we talk about football and tennis and whatever. And we get around to the case. Okay, look, your client might have a cause of action here. And this might be evidence of it. And it's a price-fixing letter to my competitor that I have not produced in discovery. And he said, well, you're damn right we got a good case, because this is what we've been looking for. You guys can go straight to hell with your own, with your seminar. Okay? I tried. You take the check. And I leave. And trial comes. And they offer the letter at trial. You're right. Your Honor, I'm flabbergasted. I offered them this document in the midst of an effort to try to save Your Honor from having to go through this horrendous lawsuit that's taking months of your time, valuable time. I offered that to them in the midst of that compromise negotiation, and they're now using it against us, and we are offended. Why do you think about it? Well, that kind of passes the last test. Just barely. I did get it in a compromise negotiation. And so they kind of saw through that pretty quickly. They had to think about that one. And then the advisory committee again put this in the rules. No, you can't, if that stuff is otherwise discoverable, you can't just preempt discovery and give it to them ahead of time and then make it through. But if I do my Goldsmith report, which is one of those squib cases, and I do it for the purpose of developing a settlement offer, and I present this report to them of how this settlement could be structured and why economically this would be advantageous to both of us, that privilege, that was prepared for settlement negotiations. But stuff that was otherwise discoverable can't be made discoverable. It's happening all the time in attorney-client privilege stuff where they're just funneling documents through their in-house counsel that are business documents. They say, we're getting the lawyer to screen them. See if we're about to step in anything over here. As we're getting involved in these business deals, we want legal advice of that lawyer with his copy that he gets. And that makes the whole document privileged, which it doesn't. That's what they're claiming.
Okay. How is the role in the book different from the one in the
manual?
You said that you said they should change the rule, but I didn't notice a difference there.
Well, maybe they did change the rule.
I just wanted to change anything.
The one in the book is, unless I have an old copy of the book, I may make my husband an old copy of the book. This was indented, I'm on page 259. Is that indented one, and then double O, indented two? Is that or just one big paragraph?
One big paragraph.
Oh, they have that. Good. God bless them. I promise you to do something right sometimes. Okay. Come on. Better make note of that. Done. All right, now, compromises in 408 and 410 are the offers of compromise rules of the Federal Rules of Evidence. And the problem here is the offer of compromise rule for civil actions, which is 408, says it is not admissible. Look at it. Not admissible to prove liability for invalidity of the claim or amendment. Not admissible, period. Then, if you look at 410, this is the one for plea bargaining in criminal cases. And note how this is worded. Evidence of the following is not in any civil or criminal proceeding admissible. Now, that clause has been left out in 408. Now, does that mean that the liability for invalidity of the claim or amount? Would that mean that a civil settlement discussion and compromise can be used in a subsequent criminal prosecution? Courts have been split. Courts have been split on it. Second Circuit said, yeah, it can be. It's almost a moot issue, though, because with speedy trial rights, criminal cases are over years before these civil things are ready for trial and are ready to be settled. So, I mean, it's an interesting exercise, not completely academic, but a good bit of it is academic. It has come up, and the courts have split on the issue, and I give you some cases on the floor. as I indicated before, they do have these confidentiality agreements that go with settlement offers, and they are very stringent with incredible penalties if they violate it, and they don't. But if they do, it has absolutely no effect on the application of Rule 408. But parties can do what they want. You can have your own deal, make it confidential, not make it confidential, whatever you want to do, structure whatever you want. It's your right to contract. But don't think your contract is affecting the application of the evidence. Not at all. No bearing on its application. I give you a number of examples from 4, 54, 66 of other purposes for which these compromising can be offered. What this privilege rule does is preclude use. It does not preclude discovery. So discovery is still possible of settlement agreements because you remember under the rules of civil procedure, which you probably would like to forget, if it is discoverable, it's admissible, or it could lead to the discovery of admissible evidence. Compromises themselves may have information in it that could lead to the discovery of this evidence. Now, you got it, when you ask for it, you're going to, I give you the cases here that are on point. There's going to be a particularized showing about how it might do that. Of course, the problem is, since you haven't seen it, you don't really know how and what it could lead to the discovery of, which, of course, is the problem you always have in discovery. When they contest that it's not relevant, it could not lead to the discovery of relevant admissible evidence, or it's privileged. How do you argue against that, since you can't see it? And if you can see it, you can make a real intelligent argument against it. That's just a problem you have. Everybody has to deal with it. Sometimes in large companies, you know, it really is a lot like the mafia of Sopranos, you know, it's just business. You know, where Tony Soprano has somebody wiped out because they go to the other side, and, you know, I'm sorry, Tony, it was just business, and they do. Well, I mean, that's really kind of the way it is, and it's just business for the boards of directors, and they're very practical. They don't get emotionally involved in this. They're very practical people, and there are occasions that I know of where the members of the board or selected committees on the board will sit in a room and listen to lawyers from both sides present their cases, and then they go back and they decide how they're going to settle the case. They just listen to the argument. The way it usually, that's from both sides in the same room. The way it usually happens, though, and that's what they're talking about here, these mock trials. The way it usually happens, though, is the law firm will hire one of its young hotshots, or assign one of its young hotshots, to counter one of his old, weathered moneymakers, the rainmaker, who's going to try the case. And he's going to put on the principal case, or if he's defending the company from a patent infringement, for example, the young hotshot will take the other side's case and will do as credible a job as they can with what they know. And they actually sometimes, good firms, they'll do a better case than the people who actually are bringing the lawsuit. They'll actually make out a more convincing case than the actual lawyers on the opposing side will, because they're better lawyers. And they do this in front of of the board. And then they talk about the credibility of the three witnesses they call. I mean, these witnesses are going to be grilled and grilled hard, just like they would be in a courtroom. And the boards of direct members of the board are going to look at that and make their assessment of how credible these people are. And this is not going to hold up in court. People are not going to believe her. This guy just looks like he's demonic. I mean, it's not just remember the judge's work. I mean, he looked demonic. There's no way he's ever going to get approved. Okay, how bright he was. He looked like Satan. He acted a little like Satan too. But you know, they're going to make those assessments and say, all right, we need to make this offer to the other side. And that's how they'll come up with their deal. And yeah, of course, the other side's not going to know about this, so they're not going to be able to discover it. This is work product preparing for litigation. What constitutes a disputed claim? Interesting, the courts have had. Some say that's just a difference of opinion. Like, what? That's a disputed claim, and therefore, offers at that point are privileged. That's interesting. Others say they have to be threatened litigation before the claim is disputed. You just need to be careful. These are evolving standards. The circuits are going different ways. The actual threatened litigation was the Tenth Circuit. The Third Circuit talked about this big old tire. Just talked about an actual dispute or difference of opinion. I mean, those are radically different standards. And so these are the kinds of issues you need to be aware of when you decide where you're going to file the cause of action, what evidentiary issues are going to come up, whether they're going to apply or there's going to be an exception. These kinds of differences in the various circuits. Now, this subsection 8 on 268, where sometimes offers of compromise are part of the cause of action, that you have to make an offer to settle, it's rejected, and then you have certain claims and rights that stem from that. Then, of course, the offer of compromise is an element, has to be established, and there's no way of getting around it. It's certainly not going to be excluded. You can't make it an element and not let it prove it. I don't know where this rule came from, and I don't know who actually proposed it. I don't know who advocated it. This is Rule 409 in the relationship section. Who does that? So, it doesn't even have to be a dispute. Being a very wealthy man, I get involved in an accident with this young kid who's like me, starting out, and, you know, wife and children, he's a salesman, and he needs his car, and a little shit was his fault. But I feel sorry for him. He was kind of polite to me. And I'm a big funder of the hospital, the wing's named after me, and I have body shops all over town. And so I call the hospital, I said, look, you got to get that arm taken care of. I don't have any insurance. I'll take care of. I'll call them and tell them that I want you taken care of. So I want you to get to the hospital. I'll call them now. I talk to them, say, what's your name? And your social security number. Okay, when you go, they'll be ready for you. And they treat him. That's privilege. But if I say, now, you may have a hard time driving if you're in a cast in your arm. You might tell them that. See if there's some other way they can find this so you can still drive. Let's get your car fixed too. We'll let the insurance company take care of this problem. My car can get fixed. My Rolls Royce will be fixed, and it'll do that. And we can get your little Pinto fixed, and we'll take it to the shop. I'll have the guys do it and get this out for you. And it'll be ready as soon as you're ready to get back on the road to keep your job. That can be used against you. Yeah, that I offered to fix his car. That can be used against me, but I offered to fix his body. That's privilege. How in the hell does that make any sense? Who proposed this rule? Who was the best in it? Who even does this? Oh, I'll pay your mini for those. Sure. I don't even know who does that. I mean, insurance companies don't do that, do they? Your insurance company pays the bill, and they sue the other insurance company. Yeah.
Actually, it's happened in my family.
It has?
Yeah. My dad ran over a little girl in his car, and he immediately offered to take her out when her car was in there that he would pay for all of her medical expenses.
Uh-huh.
And later on, they brought a lawsuit against us, and my dad was found not to be liable because of, it was construction going around, and that construction object blocked her view of us.
They used it against you.
They did not use it against you.
Well, your dad's a special person. So offer that.
Well, he felt guilty even though it wasn't technically his fault.
Yeah, you could feel guilty of a little girl lying under your car. I mean, that would do that, pull those strings. But who would lobby for this in Congress? And why would they limit it? I mean, so what if he offered to buy her new shoes because her shoes got, I mean, that could be used again.
Yeah, he didn't offer 6 bikes.
Yeah, like, because he knew, he was a lawyer and knew?
No, they just...
He was lucky.
Yeah.
He was lucky. He didn't offer to be 2 times. And I think this is perverse. Oh, well. No, but if he makes a statement, statements can be used against them. That's what's different than 408. It doesn't be a dispute. They'll make the offer to pay medical bills. If you make any statements, they got you. If you offer to buy her new shoes, new bike, or repair his car, they got you. I think this gotcha attitude is silly.
I'm a little confused on how offering to fix a car is not under 408.
It's not, is it not a claim?
Oh, I see.
Not a claim? That's disputed. So does the RML. She hasn't made a claim. She's unconscious. He hasn't made a claim yet. Or 10. Well, this is a little difficult. But let's kind of wade through this. This is the plea bargain rule. And of course, this will supersede 408. So this will be applying to criminal compromise. Now, it's important to note here what is not covered by the rule. And there are radical differences between 410 and 408. If you plead guilty in a criminal case, and your guilty plea sticks and your sentence, they find you guilty and sentence you based on your guilty plea, it's all admissible against you subsequently. This does not cover guilty pleas that stick. 408 does. Offer to settle, offer to compromise. The compromise is in a civil action. They come to fruition. Protect it. They can't use those against you. Not true of negotiated compromises in criminal cases. Okay. A plea of guilty, except as notified in rule, notice the following is not a similar criminal, so we know this is clearly not, this is out on all cases subsequent to this. Admissible against the defendant who made a plea or was a participant in the plea discussions. A plea of guilty, which was later withdrawn. So, if I answer your complaint in a civil action, and I acknowledge something. And it's like, no. Okay, I'm going to file an amended complaint, and I get it. They can offer your first complaint against you as an admission. But if you go into the criminal court, and you say, guilty! No, wait, I have a bigger problem. Not guilty. They can't offer you, against you, your first guilty plea. Why? Well, it's very simple. It's very practical. Because if you go to trial on your subsequent not guilty plea, and they bring in evidence and offer to the jury that you previously pled guilty to these charges, the trial is basically a slow guilty plea. That's what it turns into. And so if, in fact, we're going to give the defendant a fair chance at a trial that will result from a not guilty plea, you have to keep the first out. Now, you need the permission of the court to withdraw your guilty plea. You don't need that. It's any matter of time. You can file it automatically, and it supersedes your first complaint. There are consequences. You don't get to hear that until procedure. There are consequences. The criminal side, you have to ask permission to withdraw. And usually it's because I didn't understand the charges. I didn't understand that there was an element of intent involved here, and I did not have any of this intent, and I will plead not guilty. When the judge can lynch it. A plea of nolo contendere. I always think of it as the Agnew plea. Those of you who don't live in this area, our former illustrious governor in Maryland was Spiro Agnew. And he was indicted when he was vice president, which gave us Gerald Ford. Indicted because he engaged in some pretty shady stuff as governor of Maryland. He was Nixon's vice president. He pled nolo contendere. It means I make no contest. And based on that plea, they find you guilty and they enter judgment. It is the equivalent of a guilty plea. The only difference is you can't use it against me in a subsequent civil action. It can't be used as an admission. Now, interestingly, some very recent cases have come down that have said, I think it was the Second Circuit said, with aliens in the country. I always hate that word. I don't know why. I think they're from outer space. Sounds like they are. Aliens from other countries, in our country. And they were charged, and somehow they were before the Immigration Service and had proceedings ongoing, and the conditions they were here, they'd not be involved in any criminal activity. And so they were charged with a misdemeanor, and they pled nolo contendere to the misdemeanor. And the INS wants to deport them now because they have a conviction, and this is admitting they did the thing that the conviction is based on. And this, I think it was the Second Circuit said, no, you can't do that because they say I make no contest, and it's just a means of getting sentence imposed. That's a little illogical. You're going to have a sentence imposed on something that's not adjudicated? And if it's adjudicated, then don't we automatically have a basis for exporting the guy? Or deporting the guy. Deporting the guy. As bad as alien. They said you couldn't do that. I'm not sure that makes sense. But at least know there's some stuff perking out there about how you can use convictions based upon a plea of nolo contendere. He didn't do anything. Now, all you got do with a nolo contendere, you have permission of the court to enter it, but they always do it, permission of the prosecutor. They always give it to you because it's another knock on their gun. They get a guilt, then they get a conviction. Well, hell, plead whatever you want. As I get my conviction, I don't care what you plead. So they have no objection. The judge just wants to get rid of the case. But it can never be used in a subsequent civil action by the same victim. Any statement in the course of these proceedings, Rule 11. That's where you're before the court, and making sure your plea is voluntary. The outward plea is appearing to have. This guy said, I'm not guilty, but I'm going to plead guilty anyway because I really want to, and it's just in terms of the factual basis. But not only do five people want to do that, but they do sometimes. Any statement, of course, the plea is judged with an attorney. Oh, here's what happened. This is why we got this provision. Defendants would be interviewed by, it's not totally unlike you see on Law and Order, or NYPD Blue. The detectives are interviewing these people who've been arrested. And they get a statement from them. And they plead not guilty. And they go to trial, and we use a statement against them, and they move to suppress the statement. They say, they beat the hell out of me. And the cop comes in, the detective in his uniform that he wears twice a year, once for funerals, to testify somewhere. And he wears the uniform, he said, no, we didn't touch the person. And the judge always believes the guy in the uniform. So this all happens at once. I'm giving it sequentially. And he said, okay, if you didn't beat the hell out of me, he didn't even have a random warning. And the officer testifies, well, actually, we not only gave him his Miranda warnings, he looked at Spanish, so we gave him to his Spanish. And we thought, maybe he's French too, so we did that also. Just to make sure. And the judge actually believed that crap. And said, no, I think he was given his Miranda warnings. And so the confession comes in. And then the defense says, hey, no sleeping, that's a bad yawning. So the defendant says, I gave them that statement as part of an attempt to try to negotiate this plea. What? That's like, Because they said, if you cooperate with us, the prosecutor's going to be a whole lot easier on you. And I thought to myself, no, I better make a deal with these people. And so I then decided I was going to talk to them to see if I could strike a deal. And the courts had a real hard time with that, because that really passes the lab test. So their answer was a draconian new provision in the rule. Any statement made in the course of a plea discussion with an attorney for the prosecuting authority, which did not result in a plea of guilty, or which resulted in a plea of guilty later withdrawn. And so they would say, well, you make a good detective. That's not to an attorney for the prosecuting authority. They say, well, I didn't know that. He represented the government. He represented the prosecution. He said that the prosecuting authority would be easy on me. He could probably work out this deal for me. He couldn't promise anything, but he certainly would try. Now, why isn't that putting me in a position thinking he has the authority to do that? So, I mean, this was really kind of draconian. No, it had to be an attorney for the prosecuting authority. Well, the attorneys don't talk to these people. So, what the circuits have been doing, which I think is pretty reasonable in light of this stupid draconian provision, they're saying, okay, you want an attorney? Fine. And agents of the attorney for the prosecuting authority. So attorneys or their agents. The detective was the attorney's agent. That solved the problem, and now we're right back where we were before, which we had to be because of the stupid rule. And you see, the judges are making this rule make sense. It's too unfair, as I said, draconian. And so they say, nope, we're changing it. That's not fair. This is the way it's going to be interpreted. Agents, and that's basically by and large the way it's being interpreted now. So if part of the statement's offered a rule of completeness in this subsection I, or if the person's prosecuted for perjury, I think, that's the last part of that there. But that's not directly on point to what we are concerned about here. Now, in many states, a guilty plea to a misdemeanor, they exclude it because they say it doesn't really have that much probative value. A lot of times people plead guilty to a misdemeanor because they just don't want to miss another day's work. These are hourly wage workers. And they sit all day in court. You get out of the Superior Court, it's a circus. And you're there, you're not even sure your case is being called, and you can't hear half the stuff that's going on. And you're missing a whole day's work, and they if I plead not guilty, I've got to come back two or three or four times. A motion practice and a trial, and the prosecutor wants a delay for some reason or another. Obviously, guilty, and they'll fine you $10 or $100, whatever it is. guilty plea to be used against you as an admission. Federal system hasn't done that. Rule 410, it excludes the things absolutely. 410, it excludes withheld, well, these are withdrawn guilty pleas. No. Under federal rules, if you plead guilty, they can be used against you, period. We're not making the distinction under the under 410. Now, withdrawn guilty pleas are a different story. Withdrawn guilty pleas are not admissible anywhere at any time in the subject of criminal or in the subject of civil action. All of your statements, if you, by the way, if you enter the guilty plea, all the statements you make in the process of getting to that plea are also admissible against you in future litigation. Oh, and one thing that's come up is if there's a deal that I will, for charge, reduction, sentence recommendation, I will testify before the grand jury. That is not privilege. If I later testify consistent with that, they can use that against me. This doesn't make, these are not statements made as part of the plea discussion. This is a statement made as a result of the plea discussion. That is treated very differently. Now, one of the things that's happening, which the Supreme Court in this Mezzanotto case, is the U.S. attorneys are buying large. It's a seller's market. They're the seller. They're requiring you to waive your rights under Rule 410 before they talk. So that if you say things to them, you've done, and we do not reach an agreement, you do not plead guilty. If you go to trial, if you testify inconsistent with anything you say in our plea discussion, we can use them to impeach you. You don't agree to that? See. Take your chances at trial. Oh, by the way, we're adding a few more counts to your charge too. So they just automatically elevate the number of charges and the degree of the charges automatically anyway, because it forces the plea bargaining system to kick in. And then they offer you big deals. It's like, I charge three times what I should for my product, but I give you a 50% discount. You think, wow, man, that's a great store. Well, they charge me three times what they should, and then they offer me a deal, and I lead to one of those counts. But in fact, they never intend to pursue more than one of the counts anyway. And even if they did, the judge would give them concurrent sentences on both. They were convicted of both counts, and so you only need to pursue one. And in the Mezzanotto case, the Supreme Court said, well, sure, what the hell? I mean, you know, you can call it. You can agree to what you provide under these rules. Stevens had a very good point of the dissent. Stevens. There's nothing in that opinion that limits that waiver to using the statements for impeachment purposes. And that's been the complaint all along. This is just a stepping stone. And
next step the prosecutor will take. We'll say, well, we can use them, waive it, we'll use it for substantive evidence of your guilt, too, as an admission. Not as an inconsistent statement. We'll get you right out of the gates. We'll get you and bring in your admission against you if you go to trial. Could they do that? Is Souter and Stevens correct? There's nothing here that would stop that. Cortez says if you plead guilty to a criminal case, misdemeanor, felony, we don't care. It can be used against you as an admission in a later case where it's relevant. But then, the judgment that they entered on the plea, 803.22, the judgment they entered on the plea, is only admissible from criminal felony cases. So if I plead guilty to a felony, they can use my plea as an admission, and they can use the judgment to prove any fact that's essential to that plea. But if I plead guilty to a misdemeanor, they can use my guilty plea as an admission, but they can't use the judgment to prove any fact essential to sustain that sentence. Why? Isn't that totally inconsistent? So the standard for admissibility of pleas is more liberal than the standard for admissibility of judgments based on the plea. Now, of course, judgments can be based on not guilty pleas, but they're found guilty. And they say, well, a lot of times they plead guilty, they don't really mean it. But I thought we rejected that. And if we rejected that, then why shouldn't the judgment come in? Waiting for an answer from me. I don't have one. There isn't an answer, as far as I know.